Greetings, brethren. Good to
Oh,
see
Tom,
you.
I understand.
I do indeed. I'm really glad that we had that sermon. I thought it was excellent, and it really focuses us on the meaning of atonement in an interesting way. I mean, I actually opened my eyes to it a little bit more that I think there's so much to these festivals. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing, and to these things that God has us do and what it's all about. It's just truly is amazing. Well, here we are again. We just had trumpets and, we have atonement coming up. We'll be having some sobering self-examination before rejoicing exuberantly at the feast. And it was pointed out, that we have this day to think about that and think about others. And before we start, stuffing our faces and whatnot, we go to the feast. I mean, it's not, yes, we are rewarded, but there's so much in there about being outwardly focused. It actually made me think of Christ's statement, about when they were talking about when he gave him some food, and he said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." He was hungry to serve God and to serve other people. That was what he was hungry for, more than physical nourishment. That's what we need to do too. The Day of Atonement will help to get our priorities straight before this big festival. But then it's on to the feast, and it's all connected, of course. I mean, we think of this day as symbolizing the time when Satan will be bound away for 1,000 years. And of course, 1,000 years is the reign of Christ and the saints. It is the same 1,000 years. I mean, these are not unconnected. They're directly connected. I mean, you can't have the millennium and all it pictures without the binding of the devil. You can't have what the Feast of Tabernacles pictures without atonement. And it's just a truly, amazing how these so go together so lockstep. I find it interesting that the Jews, they start framing up their booths immediately at the end of atonement. So, they think, they're immediately feast focused because they have this idea that you have to carry out commandments immediately as soon as you can start them. And so then we're done with that. So we go on to the rejoicing for the feast. And that's kind of an exciting focus. Atonement itself has an excitement to it, but certainly when atonement is over, you're going to the feast, and that is just really exciting and really something to be rejoicing in. And of course, think about in the end time when Satan is finally bound, there's just this anticipation of this world, the change that's going to come. It's staggering. It really is. Well, today I actually want to give a Feast of Tabernacles message in preparation for the feast. I'm scheduled to speak at the feast. I'm giving a sermon there, but I'm also scheduled to give an alternate sermon if somebody else is not able to speak, and my guess is I won't be giving that there because it's rare that you would have to. So I thought I'll just give it here. And I also thought that, maybe if I it'll give me a chance to refine it a little bit. You might hear it twice if you go to Branson. It's probably that you won't though. So I thought it would be good to go through. And I do think it's something to kind of think about even before we get to the feast. What are we doing there? What's it all about? What are we remembering? And the title of it is Temporary Dwellings. There's nothing surprising about that. We know that's what it is. That's what it's all about, what we're going to celebrate. But let's examine the matter a little bit. I'd like you to turn over to Leviticus 23, where God lays out his festivals. Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23. Why do we do this? Why do we observe the Feast of Tabernacles? We're told right here in verses 42 through 43, it says, we can start right above this. Let's back up. He says in verse 39, on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you've gathered the fruit of the land, you'll keep a feast to the Lord for 7 days. The first day there'll be a Sabbath rest, the eighth day a Sabbath rest, and you'll take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days. So there's one thing, is this is to be a day of rejoicing. it is to be a day of rejoicing. I think there's definitely something to be said about rejoicing in the natural realm here. You know, we think of millennial settings and the beauty of God's creation and the restoration that's coming to this world. You shall keep it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever, forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. And it says, you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know, and here is the key, brethren, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now, that's interesting, because that's kind of looking back in a way. We're thinking of looking forward at the feast and what it pictures to come, but clearly there's an element of looking back. Now, the Hebrew for booth here is sukkah, and the Jews call this festival Hag HaSukkot, that is the festival of the booths, the festival of the tabernacles. Of course, a booth is a tabernacle. We think of it as a tent in that sense. More technically, I mean, it's probably a hut or some kind of shack or something like that. The idea is that this was a temporary dwelling. And the plural, of course, of sukkah is sukkot. The O-T ending is what you put on Hebrew words that have a feminine ending. If you ever see that, you see the I-M ending is the plural in Hebrew for masculine nouns, or, you know, normal words, like moedim, that is the appointed times, plural. But you have other words like shofar. I mentioned that the other day, shofarot. just a little Hebrew there, not the point. I just wanted to mention that, and that's why they call it that. But when the Israelites came out of Egypt, you know, they were sojourners. They were constantly on the move. They were living in tents. But not at first, actually. I'm going to mention that here in a second. Even God's tabernacle was just that. You know, it was a tabernacle or a tent, a temporary dwelling for God, the Mishkan, that he dwelt in. And there's a relation between these words of Sukkot and Mi is a word that makes a noun form out of things in Hebrew. It's a Mishkan. And there's a relation between that shukan and the sukkah. There's a relation in these terms. They're not exactly the same words, though. But again, it was a temporary dwelling for God. And brethren, today I want to cover five symbolic aspects of festival booths. In fact, it might be good to maybe in the title, when we title this, to say, you know, temporary dwellings, five aspects. I mean, there's five things I want to cover. And number one is that booths represent sojourning. Booths represent sojourning. When the Israelites came out of Egypt, of course, they were following the cloud. They were hiking. They were camping. I'm going to get to this in a minute. I'd like you to turn to Exodus 13 and we'll look at this. But I want to make a comment about this, because remember we just read in Leviticus 23 that he said, well, I made the Israelites dwell in booths when they came out of Egypt. Now, there's something very interesting about this, if you think about it, because he was having them take these branches and stuff and doing that, and you wonder, well, so they were just living in tents. They were going through the wilderness living in tents. That's what that's talking about. But I don't believe that's exactly accurate, because let's remember, when the Israelites left Egypt, they left from Ramesses. You can find this in a few places. They went from Ramesses to where? They went from Ramesses to Sukkot. That was their first encampment, was called Sukkot. Why was it called that? Was it already called Sukkot and they just happened to arrive there? I don't believe that. I believe that the reason it was called Sukkot is because they set up Sukkot there. They said that's why they named it that when they first left Egypt. These were people who lived in mud brick houses in Egypt. They didn't have, actually, we think of these Bedouin tents, these goat hair tents that, you know, you see in biblical times that the patriarchs dwelt in. And, you know, you later see people making these kinds of tents. Paul was a tent maker. He probably made these goat hair tents. And this was, you know, with their flocks and stuff, that they would actually make these tents that they would roam around with these flocks. And obviously they weren't the same as these mud brick houses that the Israelites were dwelling in Egypt. So if you think of these slaves in Egypt leaving the country, that they probably didn't all have goat hair tents. That wasn't what they lived in normally. They didn't have that. And later in the Exodus wanderings, you do find clear mentions of tents. You find mentions of them dwelling in their tents, and Moses had a tent, and different people had tents, and the tents of these guys were over here, and the tents of these guys were over here. So later, everybody has tents. Well, of course, they lived in the wilderness for years and they had flocks and they were shearing their goats and they were able to take the wool from those goats and make tents. So they had tents later, but right when they left Egypt, they didn't have tents. So they built these sukkahs. That's what they had when they left, when they went to Sukkot. That was the name of the place. And I find it interesting. It mentions as they went and they were in these campments, at the one place it said they encamped and there were 70 palm trees there. It actually mentions that. So I think that probably has something to do with that. They needed, number one, it's kind of a shady area, but maybe they were using some of these to make booths. Now, I don't see how they possibly made enough booths, by the way. You'd think they would have denuded all the trees going along on their wanderings to do this. It just, I'm not sure how that went. But I suspect that there was a lot, that was a lot more lush area than it is now. You know, now it's very desert-like, and there was times in the past when it seemed like more things grew through the Sahara and these other areas around there. It must have been that there were more trees. Otherwise, I just don't see how they could have done this even. But anyway, that's what they were building there. But they were doing that as they were following this symbolism of being sojourners. You know, the booths represent sojourning. We can read Exodus 13. It says here in verses 21 through 22, "And the Lord went before them," this is when they left Egypt, "in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people." And this is just an amazing thing. I always think about how this, I mean, you have this visible presence of God hovering over your nation as you're leaving. It is astounding. It kind of makes you wonder how you could ever have sort of lacked faith in that sense, as the people did. They were very physical and carnal. I don't want to say that we wouldn't in the same circumstance. We don't know, although we do have God's Spirit to help us, but those people didn't. But I mean, you just imagine this. You're following this pillar of cloud and fire. And actually, it was a covering. We'll find out about that in just a minute after you turn there, that it was a protection as well for them. And it led them through the darkness. But Numbers 9 tells us about this as well. If you turn over there, Numbers 9. Clearly, there was no permanence in what they were doing. They had left these mud brick houses, and they weren't in those houses anymore. They were on the move. It's not so easy to pick up, you know, maybe have prefab houses today that you can load up on a trailer or something, but that's not even an easy thing. I mean, maybe you have a trailer, that might be a little bit easier. You hook it to the big truck and you drive it. But I mean, and then these people didn't just, well, we got to gather up all our mud bricks and try to haul them and set up new houses. They were on the move, and that's part of what this was symbolizing. They had to be on the move. So Numbers 9, we read what they did in verses 15 through 23. "Now on the day that the tabernacle was raised up," this was talking about the Mishkan, God's tabernacle, "the cloud covered the tabernacle." This is wherever it was set up, the cloud of God would come down over the tabernacle in the tent of the testimony. "And from evening till morning, it was above the tabernacle like the appearance of fire." That's just, again, awesome. Right in the midst of that camp, they were all camped around the tabernacle, and right there in the midst was this massive pillar of cloud and fire that was there. "So it was always," think of that, "so it was always," is the statement. For 40 years, they wandered through that. And by the way, that cloud and fire didn't go away. I mean, it lasted through the tabernacle through when Israel came into the land, and it was over Solomon's temple too. I mean, this is stunning to think about. "Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, after that the children of Israel would journey. And in the place where the cloud settled, there the children of Israel would pitch their tents. At the command of the Lord, the children of Israel would journey, and at the command of the Lord they would camp." But the way that command was apparently communicated was the movement of that cloud. They watched it. What did it do? Did it stay? Were they to stay? Did it go? Then they would need to go, because it says, "As long as the cloud stayed above the tabernacle, they remained encamped. Even when the cloud remained long, many days above the tabernacle, they could stay put." And you think, wow, you start to develop some sort of a seemingly permanent existence here. We've got a permanent establishment. We're here for years, or even possibly. We know that the tabernacle was there for a year at Mount Sinai. Therefore, there was there was all this, this motion. Even when it continued long, you know, they stayed there. They did not journey. They kept the charge of the Lord and did not journey. So it was, when the cloud was above the tabernacle a few days, according to the command of the Lord, they would remain encamped, and according to the command of the Lord, they would journey. So it was. I think he's trying to make a point here, because I think, well, I understand this, but he says it many times. He's trying to make the point. He says, so it was when the cloud remained only from evening till morning. When the cloud was taken up in the morning, they would journey. Sometimes it was only one night. Whether by day or night, whenever the cloud was taken up, they would journey. Whether it was 2 days, a month, or a year that the cloud remained above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would remain encamped and not journey, but when it was taken up, they would journey. At the command of the Lord, they remained in camp, and at the command of the Lord, they journeyed. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. This is a fascinating passage. When you read this and you think, well, he told me this a number of times here, kind of how this would go. But he's trying to really hammer the point that it didn't matter how long they stayed. It wasn't permanent. They would go. And sometimes it was very brief when they would be there. And then they would go. They just had to go wherever God went. They had to follow. They had to follow that cloud. And remember, the Lord was in that cloud. That was Yeshua, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, who later came to the earth, was actually the Lord, Yahweh, who was in that cloud. And they followed that cloud wherever it went. And we are to follow that cloud, brethren, wherever it is. And that we know that is our Lord, Jesus Christ. We are to follow Him. So the Israelites were essentially sojourners. And one thing I want to stress about this is that they were sojourners even when they got to the promised land. I'd like you to look over Leviticus 25. Because we kind of have this sense that, well, they were wandering, and then they finally got to the promised land, and that was the permanence, in a sense. And there's certainly a type of permanence. You go from this wandering to this establishment in the land of promise. That's clearly a time of permanence. But it really wasn't permanent. Look at Leviticus 25. In verse 23, it says the land, and this is talking about how, you know, you'd have the land divided between people, shall not be sold permanently. This is even from where they lived on it. If you were to sell the land to somebody, that would not be permanent. For the land is mine. The land is mine. And here's the next thing I want you to key in on. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. Notice that. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. In the promised land, it was going to be this way he was talking about. In the promised land, they would still be these strangers and sojourners with God. Because he was a sojourner there. He dwelt in a tabernacle that moved. And then we come to 1 Chronicles 29, 15. 1 Chronicles 29, 15, if you look over there. 1 Chronicles 29:15 tells us that, and this was what David prayed after the Israelites brought the offering to build the temple. He said something about this. 1 Chronicles 29:15, and you think, wow, David has this capital here at Jerusalem. They're building a temple. It all seems so permanent. But David makes the point, you know, verse 15 of 1 Chronicles 29, for we are aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers. Our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope. There's a number of images that come together in here. I mean, that shows you the fleetingness of this physical life. That is demonstrated in this aspect of being aliens and pilgrims, strangers, sojourners, travelers. We are moving through this world, and brethren, we are moving through this world as travelers, as sojourners, as temporary dwellers in this world. We are, this world itself is not permanent. Now, Solomon built the temple as a symbol of future permanence. But it wasn't because actual, you know, permanence had been achieved. there was a transition here actually between David's reign to the time of Solomon's reign. Remember, David fought, he fought many wars, and it was the time of wars. But then you had Solomon, who was the son of peace, and Solomon certainly was able to have an established kingdom. He had a lot of military power in that sense, but his time of reign was a time of peace. It was actually, his name meant the son of peace, and his reign was symbolic of the kingdom in that sense. Actually, if you read about his reign, it says it was one long feast, and they were sacrificing tons of animals, they were eating all this food. It was a long feast. His reign was like a feast, and it was a type of the coming kingdom, because Solomon himself, the son of David, was a type of the son of David, the Messiah, who would come and set up the kingdom of God. And Solomon, I don't want to say anything negative about him in this context. He had this powerful kingdom that reigned over other nations. This was very symbolic. All of this was symbolic of what's coming. And so at that time, of course, that's why you had the building of the physical temple that symbolized this more permanence that went from the tabernacle that was moving around to now a solid structure, this temple that was going to be a symbol of the more permanent setting of the kingdom. And this is all very meaningful. But it wasn't utterly permanent yet. And we know it didn't last. That temple was destroyed. And so was the one they built after that. Those are gone. And all those things that they had then are gone because it was all temporary. None of it was lasting. And all of the people are dead. And we'll talk about them and their bodies as well as are symbolized in this sense. But I want us to turn over to 1 Peter 2, 11. 1 Peter 2. Because this does not only apply to the ancient Israelites, it applies to the Israelites, the spiritual Israelites today, God's people, His church. 1 Peter 2, and this is in verse 11. He's telling them, stay away from the physical things. And of course, this is what we also think about in terms of the Day of Atonement. Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. And you think about that in the context of the Feast of Tabernacles, it's very interesting because you're kind of, indulging physical pleasures and joy and doing these things, and that's good. But we still have to keep this perspective, and that's why it's good for the Day of Atonement, right? That comes right before that we are to have a governor and realize that we are sojourners and pilgrims. We're not of this world. We are in it. We are in this world and not of it. If we were of this world, we'd be like it, and we are not, as we're told in other verses. Again, we follow Christ wherever He goes. And, He's taken us through different locations. We've had to move, physically. But even if you think organizationally, He's taken us to different things. We had an organization that didn't work out. And we moved to a different one. We had to set up a new tent, as it were. We had to encamp somewhere else because we had to follow the cloud. We had to follow the Lord to where He was and where His truth was, and we have to do that. We like it when we get to rest for a while, and we don't have to move, but we should never have a sense of permanence here. That's this whole thing about, our citizenship is in heaven, ultimately. This is all impermanent. It is not permanent. We are strangers and pilgrims. We are looking forward to the day when we arrive at our final destination in the kingdom of God. Number two, brethren, booths represent God's protection. Booths represent God's protection. Turn over to Isaiah 4. This is just an amazing passage to me. I originally had this as sort of the end of my sermon, but I actually think I need to say this up front to make some points about it. I'll read more of this at the end, but I want us to cut into it here. In verses 5 and 6 of Isaiah 4, this whole passage here is talking about the return of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom and the millennium and what's going to happen. But one of the things we read about here is we read in verses 5 and 6. Then the Lord, notice the wording, Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion. This is in the future when the kingdom is set up. The Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all there will be a covering, a huppah. That's what you see in a Jewish wedding. They have this covering, this huppah. And I think there's a tie-in to this. If you think about that future kingdom and the wedding and all these kind of things, it's an amazing picture. But I have to say, one thing I want us to notice here is that the pillar of cloud and fire, it's coming back. It's going to be there. It's going to be there in Jerusalem through the millennium. It's going to be there. And notice this. For over all the glory there will be a covering, and there will be a tabernacle, and the word here is sukkah. And there will be a sukkah. That's what it says right here. There will be a sukkah. What is it talking about? It's actually talking about the pillar of cloud and fire itself. There will be a sukkah for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, for a shelter from storm and rain. And that shows you, brethren, what it's talking about. There will be a sukkah. Sukkot are shelters. And the pillar of cloud and fire was a shelter. It was God's protection from heat, from storm and rain. When the people wandered through the desert, they were covered by this cloud that kept them in the shade. And it's going to be that way in Jerusalem again. And it is a symbol, though. It is a symbol that shows God's protection. That's what it means. You think if you've got a roof over your heads, I'm protected. Actually, the base meaning of Sukkot is a Sukkah, which is the roof. That's what it means. You have a roof. You have something over your head that is protecting you from the elements. In other words, there is a protection that God's cloud and fire provided for the people as they went through the wilderness. And so the symbolism of tabernacles is a symbol of God's protection. That's what this is, his protection and watching over and standing guard over his people. There's some very interesting imagery in Revelation 7. I'd like you to turn to Revelation 7. And in Revelation 7, you see this image of this multitude that comes out of the tribulation. And there's a lot of symbolism here. And so I don't know what all of this is literal and what all of it is figurative. But one thing I want to point out about it is when it's showing these people in Revelation 7 verse 9, says, after these things I looked and behold a great multitude which no one could number of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues standing before the Lord, before the Lamb. Notice this, clothed with white robes with palm branches in their hands. That is directly related to the Feast of Tabernacles because that's what they were to take in the law at the Feast of Tabernacles. And here you see them with the palm branches. Of course, you know that when Jesus entered in Jerusalem, they went and got palm branches and they laid them before him because that was a future symbol they were looking toward. They did that. But this is talking about these who come out of the tribulation, the end, with these palm branches. And then notice this in verse 16. This is what's going to happen with them. God's talking about how they're before God serving him. In verse 16, they shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. And, you know, you had the fitting atonement symbolism, which comes right before that. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. They're going to be under that cloud of protection, under the sukkah. They will be protected under God's pillar of cloud and fire. They will have that as a protection, is what this is showing. So they're under God's protection and care. That's a very important symbolism of tabernacles, of booths. Number three, booths represent harvest shacks. This is something we don't often think about, but you can find it right in the Bible. And I will read a verse to you that you know. I'll just refer to it. It's one you are very familiar with. While I have you turn over to Isaiah 1, if you would. I'll have you turn over to Isaiah 1. The verse I'll read to you is actually in Exodus 23:16. You know, Exodus 23:16 talks about the three festival seasons in the year. And it says this, and the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors which you've sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end or the turn of the year when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. The Feast of Tabernacles is also called the Feast of Ingathering. It's celebrating this ingathering of the great harvest late in the year. It's this late harvest that comes in, and all the great abundance is that harvest, and that's what the Feast of Tabernacles is symbolizing. It's the ingathering. It's the bringing in of all of this fruit of your labors from the field and rejoicing in that. And we think, well, what's the tie-in? Why is there booths and tabernacles? What does that have to do with ingathering? Is there any tie-in between booths and ingathering? You think, maybe these are just kind of disconnected things. They have nothing to do with one another. But brethren, they have to do exactly with one another. And we could see it here in Isaiah 1 and verse 8. It's talking about how bad it's going to be for Israel in the future. And it says, so the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. What is this talking about? This is talking about a booth and a vineyard. This is talking about a shelter, a sukkah, that's the word here, is left as a sukkah in a vineyard. Talking about a structure that would be set up in the vineyard, in the gardens, that when they're out there harvesting in the field, they need some rest. They need some shade. They go over to the water station. They've got it set up under here, under this little temporary thing that they just set up, so that they go get their drinks, they could get some rest, they could come out of the heat, they could be in the shade, they bring some of their fruit over there, they bring it into these shelters so it won't spoil any further. This is what this is. I mean, think about this in terms of the spiritual harvest and how amazing this picture is. And again, this was a shelter from heat, from rain and storm. If storms came early, they normally would come after the Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, they prayed for rain during the feast and they were waiting for the rains. They might come early and that would be kind of miserable, so they'd need a place to get out of that. But ultimately, I want to say this. This is ultimately looking forward to the millennial harvest of people of all nations. When the millennial harvest happens, when all these nations are brought in, there's a place that we can gather and rest. We are all, you know, under these booths in the field while the harvest is going on, and we bring everybody into the booths. And they are come under God's protection and providence. This is a symbol that is remarkable, because again, we're so disconnected from the agricultural world that we don't see how so tied these things are to agriculture, but they are. And even the existence of booths has something to do with, yes, God said he gave it because when the Israelites were brought out, but we know that when God says he does something for a certain reason, God doesn't always tell us what all the reasons are. There's many layers to all of God's instructions. And here, I think this is a perfect case in point. I mean, he doesn't explicitly say in the law, and I'm going to get you to think about this aspect of ingatherings when you're doing this too, but it would have made them automatically think about it. We don't think about it because we're not out there in booths in the field, but they were. And so that they think the only time they build booths is when they go out in the field and then when they have the Feast of Tabernacles. It's directly tied together for them in that sense, in the way that they would think. Number four is that booths represent fleeting yet abundant existence. Booths represent fleeting yet abundant existence. I mean, in one sense, we think about the temporary nature of it, but we don't have to be stuck on that aspect of it. I do want to give some focus to it because that's important. The Jews see in the sukkah or booth a symbol of human frailty, which is interesting because you have other places where our bodies are compared to a tent. We'll look at that in a minute. But they look at the sukkah or booth as a symbol of human frailty. And when they build their booth, they maintain that it has to be a flimsy structure because it needs to show that. And actually, another reason for that, you can see over in Genesis 33. I'd like you to go over there because it actually tells us the meaning of this word. I mean, that's what I find interesting here in this verse. Genesis 33, it says this in an interesting way. And I don't think this is coincidental that this just happened to be stated. This is by way of explanation of something. Genesis 33, verse 17. This is after, you know, Jacob left from Esau. He came back from Syria, and he had this whole encounter with Esau, and then he went off with his family. And it says in verse 17, and Jacob journeyed to Sukkot. Now here's an interesting case again, why you say, well, was it already called that? We know it was not already called that because of what follows in the verse. This is why it became called that. It says, and Jacob journeyed to Sukkot. It's telling you this is where he went. It wasn't called that yet, but it says, he built himself a house and made booths, Sukkot, for his livestock. So these were basically some kind of stables he made. He made a house for himself, and he made booths, Sukkot, for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkot. That's what I really want you to observe. It says, therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkot. It's called Sukkot because he built these Sukkot for his livestock there. He built himself a house. Clearly, there is a difference in what he built. I mean, he built something that he intended to have more of a sense of permanence, and the other was this thing he built for his livestock. He's saying, well, that sounds kind of ratty. Stable. I mean, that's not, you know, sounding very good. But really, I mean, this idea of a temporary dwelling, I mean, here it has a sense of a temporary structure. And that's what they would build. And they built that, you know, when the Israelites came out, and they built that as, you know, following these commands for a while, evidently. But I want to interject an odd fact here. And that is that the Israelites apparently did not build booths for 1,000 years. If you look at, I'm going to show you that here in a second. If you turn over to Nehemiah chapter 8, it's sort of an odd thing. You read this, and I still don't know what exactly to make of this, but I find it, I think it's good to look at it as we come up on the Feast of Tabernacles and kind of wonder why this is or what's going on here. Now, you know, there were various times when the Israelites lost aspects of the law. In Josiah's day, they found the book of the law and they read it and they mourned. They were so sad for what they hadn't been doing. This happened again at the time of the return of the exiles. And Ezra is reading the law to the people, and they just all started crying. This was on the Feast of Trumpets. And they had to be told, don't cry. This is a day that's holy, and you're to rejoice in it. And they actually, well, they were sad because they realized they had kind of drifted away from these things. And I find this very remarkable. In Nehemiah 8, verses 13 through 18, it says, now on the second day, that's the day after trumpets, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people with the priests and Levites were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. And they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month. Now I want to explain something, by the way. The exiles had actually kept the Feast of Tabernacles. You can read in Ezra 3:4. The Israelites had kept the Feast of Tabernacles, it says, when they returned. So the Feast of Tabernacles was being observed in some way, but not this way. This is what I want to stress here. It says, they found in the law which the Lord had commanded by Moses that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go to the mountain, bring olive branches, branches of oil trees, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of leafy trees to make booths, as it is written. Well, one thing is interesting is it is not exactly written that way in Leviticus 23. Those are two separate things. It tells them to take the branches in one place, and it says, and make booths in another. Here you see that that was connected, but it wasn't explicitly connected, and that may contribute why this wasn't done. But here it says, as it's written, this is what they were supposed to do. So anyway, they as it is written, so they did that. Then the people went out and brought them and made themselves booths, each one on the roof of his house or in their courtyards or the courts of the house of God, in the open square of the water gate, in the open square of the gate of Ephraim. So the whole assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and sat under the booths. Now this is the amazing statement. For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, until that day, the children of Israel had not done so. Again, that was about 1,000 years from about the time, the 1300s up until right around 400, that when this was happening. This was a long time. And there was very great gladness. Also, day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read from the book of the law of God. They kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day, there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. So, again, this is very odd. They had been keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, but they had not been building these booths. And remember, Solomon dedicated the temple of God in a 2-week period that included the Feast of Tabernacles. But apparently the people had not been doing the dwelling in booths at that time. Apparently not with booths, including under righteous King David. There's no question about was a righteous king. But yet they weren't doing it in his day and Samuel's day. They weren't doing it through the whole Judges period. Not since the time of Joshua had they done this. And that is astonishing to me. Maybe they just thought that the palms and the other branches were for waving and rejoicing, while the commandments about the booths were satisfied by tents, or maybe they just didn't think they needed to have booths. Maybe they thought they were under the pillar of cloud and fire, which was a sukkah, a tabernacle of refuge, and maybe they thought that. I don't know what they thought. But at the time of Ezra, you know, this aspect of worship was restored to them. And we note we may also note, though, that at that time they did not have the pillar of cloud and fire in Ezra's day. They didn't have that. But I don't think that's the determining factor there, because the Israelites who dwelt in booths also had the pillar of fire as well. They had both. So it's just interesting to me. I really don't understand what is going on there, but I do find it interesting that for all that time they hadn't done that. You read other things like this too, like in Hezekiah's day when they restored the Passover, you find it hadn't been done since when, and you think this was all during heavy biblical God intervening times, and yet they didn't get that part. And yet there's, you know, we see through a glass darkly, brethren. We don't know all of these things, and one day we will understand it. But now today, people don't typically stay in an actual booth for the festival or even a tent as in past days. People usually opt for nicer accommodations, seeing the need for a luxurious dwelling to rejoice in, because we were commanded to rejoice. And you think, I'm not going to be rejoicing in something where I might get rained on or whatnot. But of course, even, you know, we look at this building, we think this is permanent. This is a permanent structure, but it could be blown flat by natural causes. An earthquake could shake it right to the ground. A tornado come through. It's all gone. Auditoriums, hotels, they may be sturdier than lean-tos, than shacks or tents, but ultimately they too are temporary. They are all temporary. Everything is temporary. Everything we see is temporary all around us. It's all temporary. Now, on the rejoicing side, it should be recognized that even a Jewish sukkah, a booth that they would build, though temporary and frail, could still be splendid and sumptuous, because it's, again, a symbol of God's protection, hearkening back to the time when they dwelt beneath the protective pillar of cloud and fire. And even God's tabernacle was, in this sense, a temporary tent. And it was very rich and splendid. There was no expense spared. I mean, this was a beautiful thing, but they could take it down and move it. It was on the go. But, you know, even, you know, we speak of our temporary quarters for the feast as supposed to typify royal dwellings. And that makes sense, because the tabernacle, again, was God's royal dwelling. But still, we have to remember that everything that's physical is temporary. It is all here for only a time. Now, considering that the Jews view booths as representative of human frailty, it's interesting to note what the New Testament says about our physical bodies, that they're tents or tabernacles. Look over at 2 Corinthians 5. 2 Corinthians 5. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and we look at verses 1 through 5, for we know, Paul says, that if our earthly house, this tent, so he's clarifying that, you know, again, we may seem to have a sense of permanence here, the place we live in our bodies, but it's a tent. It's a mobile home, in other words, is destroyed. We have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, you know, this body's a pain, but we need a body. We don't want to get rid of that. But further clothed, that mortality, the impermanence in that sense, may be swallowed up by life, by eternal life. Now, he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who's also given us the Spirit as a guarantee. That gives us permanence within this tent. But it's because we're waiting for what's coming. And 2 Peter 1, I'll just refer you to this verse. 2 Peter 1, verses 13 through 14, Peter said, "Yes, I think it's right, as long as I'm in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that shortly I must put off my tent, just as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me." Meaning he's going to be dead because his body is not going to work anymore, and it has to be cast off and, you know, remade into the perfect body from heaven. This is, again, a symbol of this temporary dwelling that you have only for a time. And of course, you know, you think about that, but God didn't intend us to be miserable in this tent. This is not what we were made for. In fact, God intends even our physical lives to be abundant and prosperous. We're told that in John 10:10 that they may have life more abundantly. John said in 3 John 2 that you may prosper in all things. This is now in the flesh, in this physical tent, we're to have abundance and prosperity. That's the ideal. That doesn't mean it always goes that way. But God wants to bless us with that. And certainly we're to rejoice in that to the utmost in terms of the Feast of Tabernacles. Yes, it's temporary, but it's to be with this focus on rejoicing and enjoying the prosperity and the abundance that we've been given. And in fact, that's why God tells us to save second tithe. We go there so we'll have money and we won't be miserable because we're dead broke. That's part of it. And if we don't have that, maybe we can get help from others. Obviously, we all help each other to rejoice. But that is what we do. And number five, finally, we'll come to the last point here, is that booths, and I have a few verses to go to though still, but booths represent the millennial period. This actually was something that kind of bugged me for a while about the Feast of Tabernacles. I'll just say this candidly, is I couldn't get it, you know, because I kept thinking to myself, we're waiting for the permanence of the kingdom, and the time today is this time of impermanence, this time of being a temporary sojourner, temporary dweller today. So I thought, why do we go to the Feast of Tabernacles to celebrate temporariness? It seemed backwards to me. It didn't actually make any sense. And I thought, well, we're just remembering that we're temporary now because we're getting permanence later. But still, it just didn't seem to fit to me. I didn't understand, why are you dwelling in booths for the Feast of Tabernacles? Why are you having a temporary existence? Why aren't you doing something that would seem more permanent? It just didn't make sense to me. And so, finally, I got this was a long time ago that I got this. I mean, this wasn't something new, but it finally came to me that, you know, we understand, brethren, the way that the plan of God is laid out, that the Feast of Tabernacles represents the time of the millennium, when God's kingdom will be set up on earth. And again, it might seem odd why that period would be symbolized by temporary dwellings, because temporary dwellings would seem to symbolize the here and now, not the time of the millennium. And it could be, you know, again, it could be argued the point is to make us mindful of our temporary dwellings so that we'll want the permanent dwellings. I'm not going to say there's nothing to that. I think there is something to that. That's true. But it seems more germane to the feast to consider this fact that we also believe and know, that the millennial period itself, along with the white throne judgment that follows, is temporary. It is temporary too. It is the time of temporary dwellings or booths. The whole world is temporary in that sense. It's passing away in one sense. And the millennium is going to be a period of temporariness too. It'll be the grandest, most wonderful, most prosperous, and abundant temporary period ever. It'll be the greatest time of temporariness ever, but it is still temporary and fleeting. It is still not the permanent dwelling. And while our spirit bodies at that time that we will receive, when we're resurrected at Christ's return, our spirit bodies will be permanent, incorruptible dwellings. We will have a permanence that is secured in that sense. The rest of mankind will still dwell in physical fleshly bodies. But even for us, there will still be an aspect of temporary dwellings, because our dwelling place at that time, you know, the surface of the earth, including the millennial temple at Jerusalem, that's also temporary. The where we will live in the millennium, even though we will have a permanent body, where we will live, this will still be a temporary dwelling. The millennial earth, the millennial Jerusalem, the millennial temple in Jerusalem will all be temporary. It's all going to be replaced at the time of the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem for which we wait. We read about that, of course, in Revelation 21 and 22. Remember in Hebrews 11, I'd like you to turn over to Hebrews 11. As we're waiting for that very much, brethren, that's what we are ultimately waiting for. In Hebrews 11, verses 8 through 10, going back to the Father of the faithful, and we follow this example. Hebrews 11, 8 through 10, By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. And by faith, he dwelled in the land of promise, as in a foreign country. I mean, that's an interesting thing about Abraham, is he was in the promised land, but he was there as a temporary sojourner. Now you think, well, even later when his descendants got the promised land, they were still temporary sojourners, including God himself was there as a temporary sojourner. It's amazing. But why did Abraham do this? You know, he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Because they had a promise. That's why they went. That's why they did this sojourning. 4, verse 10, he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. That is the permanence that is coming. And he waited for that. And he was our example in waiting for that. We also are waiting for that city whose builder and maker is God. The one that has these foundations. That is an amazing picture. You know, notice this too from the end of the millennium. I'd like you to turn over to Revelation 20. Revelation 20 verse 9. Then it's talking about these forces of Gog and Magog that come against God's followers at the end of the millennium. You know, Satan is released for a brief time. He leads this great rebellion and people follow him. And they come to try to fight, you know, God's people. And notice this, Revelation 20, verse 9. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. This is the millennial Jerusalem. And I just find it interesting that we're referring here to the camp of the saints. See that? This is a camp of the saints. In the holy city. It's not permanent, brethren. That is all. They're camping out. They're waiting for the future, and we will still be camping out in a sense, waiting for that new heavens and new earth. And turn over to Isaiah 33, though. You know, even though, brethren, the millennial world and the millennial temple itself will be temporary, awaiting the new heavens and the new earth, we can be thankful about this. Our wandering on this earth will at last be over. Even, you know, when the millennium itself comes, our wandering will be over. But ultimately it will be for all people. Isaiah 33, verse 20 is a wonderful picture of the future. It says, look upon Zion, Isaiah 33, 20, look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. You know, it's temporary. It was then, it was destroyed. It's going to be rebuilt, but it's not going to last. Ultimately, even the millennial Jerusalem is not going to last. But it says, your eyes will see Jerusalem, a quiet home, a tabernacle that will not be taken down. You think about in the wilderness, how they would take it down and go on the move. But no more will you have this sense of a tabernacle taken down. Not one of its stakes will ever be removed, nor will any of its cords be broken. It's going to be permanent. Ultimately, it's going to be permanent. And that's the permanence that we seek. And finally, brethren, let's turn back to Isaiah 4, where we were earlier. And let's think about this picture in Isaiah 4. We'll close with this. In Isaiah 4, we'll start reading in verse 2, because this is where we really get the sense of this. In that day, and we're talking about, again, at the time of the return of Christ, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious. I want you to notice that there's several themes intersecting here. You know, there's prophecies in the scripture where Jesus is called the branch. He's the branch that branches out from David. He's the branch as a figurative person talking about him as the Messiah that's branch out from the tree of Israel, branch out from the tree of David's lineage, a rod of Jesse. You know, this is who we're talking about. There's other prophecies that show, behold, my servant who is called the branch, God says. And here you can say, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. This is the Messiah, Jesus Christ. But there's also obviously some tie-in to the gathering of branches that the people did for the Feast of Tabernacles celebration, which puts people in mind of that. Is the leading branch, of course, is him. The Bible also refers in other places to God's people, like his branches. You know, he even refers to us as trees. He shall be a tree that grows, planted by the riverside, which in season yields its fruit, green its leaves abide. That's the righteous. That's what we're to be, growing by the river, nourished by the Holy Spirit, growing as a tree. And the leading one among us is this one, the branch, Jesus Christ. And he is going to be beautiful and glorious. And you have this, again, tabernacles picture of these booths. And the fruit of the earth. And remember that they were to take the branches and they were to take the fruit, it says, and they were to rejoice. But here you see the beautiful branch, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped. This is a Feast of Tabernacles image in this verse. And it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Zion will be called holy, everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and purge the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. That's when all the horrible stuff of the tribulation, the day of the Lord period, is going to be a burning period, a burning away of unrighteousness, a judgment, a heated fire where our God, the consuming fire of the pillar of cloud and fire, comes down and consumes the wicked. Then, verse 5, then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering, and there will be a sukkah, the tabernacle. This cloud will provide that for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, for a shelter from storm and rain, for God's protection, his divine presence and protection. That, brethren, is the millennial tabernacle. And what a wonderful world is in store under the rule and protection of the great God, indeed the great God family, which will include us if we remain faithful.